From SDPB Radio, I'm Josh Heyer, and you're listening to the In the Moment News Podcast. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from across the state. Listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or tell your smart speaker, play SDPB. You can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to the In the Moment Segments Podcast. And now, it's your weekly roundup in news coverage. The death of George Floyd last week in Minneapolis weighs heavy on the minds of people all over America. Some of those people gathered for a peaceful protest Monday in Sioux Falls. Two of the speakers at that protest joined us to share their message and their hopes for moving ahead with positive change.
Vanny Harari is a frequent guest here on In the Moment. He's the co-founder of Think3D Solutions in Sioux Falls. He's also a civic leader and an ambassador for the community. Vanny, welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for taking time for us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
We're also joined today by Julian Beaudoin, Vice President of Establishing Sustainable Connections and the Assistant Director of the South Dakota African American History Museum. Beaudoin is also a state law enforcement officer. Julian, thanks to you as well for being with us today.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me.
So we'll start with you, Vanny, and then move to Julian. For those who weren't able to attend yesterday's rally in Sioux Falls, give us maybe a brief summary of what you decided to highlight in your comments yesterday.
Yeah. So, you know, my position was basically coming from the point of activity, is that we are out there because we are tired of being frustrated. We're tired of being angry. We want to see action and activity. We want our allies to be accomplices and help us in doing that. And it's not just a matter of hurting. It's a matter of healing. And it's a matter of us saying, what can we actually do? And what are people willing to do for us to better the situation? So we're not in a position to have to protest at all.
And Julian, you also have your law enforcement background. Tell us what your message was yesterday.
Yeah, my message really was about peace and unity. When I spoke, we did so in Venice Park, right next to the statue of Dr. King. And that was purposely done. The symbolism of Dr. King is of peace and also of unity. But I also wanted to make sure people understood what Dr. King really stood for. And he did not stand for the injustices that we see across our nation, whether it's injustice in our judicial system or even within the law enforcement agencies across our nation. And so I wanted to make sure that we displayed those, but we also talked about how to move forward and with unity and with clarity.
This, of course, is an ongoing situation. Every few years, it seems, a particularly heinous situation captures national attention, and we see situations like this. Julian, I'll start with you. How do you want folks who showed up yesterday to continue on the same energy when everyone else's attention moves away? How do you continue keeping an eye to justice?
You know, normally what I would say is it begins with conversation. But, you know, unfortunately, we've been having the same conversation year after year after year. And so now it's to the point now where we are past the conversation part. And we're to the part to where we need to start educating. And so conversation moves to education. Education moves to action, in my opinion. What action looks like to me is getting our young individuals and harnessing that energy from yesterday, having them run for office, having them serve on different local and state committees, but also having them participate in the process of policy writing, having them participate in the process creating procedures that look equitable. We talk a lot about equality, but we know we can't get to equality without equitable policies. So having them actually participate in that process, it shows me that not only can they harness that energy, but they actually care about what their future looks like.
And Vanny, what do you have to add to that?
I mean, I think that's pretty spot on. I think, you know, what you saw there was is a huge opportunity to communicate to a lot of our young people that this is, in fact, their community. I think when you see people act out in that way, it's because they don't feel like it's theirs. One of the common tropes when we see people act out in various ways is, why would they break their own stuff? It's because they don't feel like it's theirs. Many of these people were murdered in their own neighborhoods in front of their neighbors. And so how do we let young people know they have opportunities and options? How do we let them know that this is their community and they should protect it? And we see both sides of it. There's young people out there cleaning up the aftermath right now. And so how do we activate them and put them in the right place? But it also means that for our leadership, we have to have a different position about representation. We virtually have zero representation in almost every level of leadership, C-suites, nonprofit, political, you name it. We have to talk about how we can increase that and develop leaders so we can go into the future with people that have that perspective and context.
We've talked a bit this hour about the situation that developed at Empire Mall, that some of the burglary and things like this. But Sioux Falls leaders have said, and I've seen it elsewhere as well, and even from journalists covering the situation, that that wasn't the spirit of the event yesterday. It was largely a very separate situation. So, Vani, talk to us about the feeling of yesterday's event. Describe for us how that unfolded.
It was beautiful. And that's why I would say anyone, you know, you can look at both events and see that they had nothing, you know, to do with each other. And as I pointed out elsewhere, if somebody was to conflate those, it would require intention, right? You would have to purposely try to make those one thing. And that's what we have to make sure that we do better. I saw thousands and thousands of South Dakotans coming together for a cause to say that we want to do better in our community. People raising their hands saying, what can I do? How can I participate? People showing out in love and in solidarity. And that is a beautiful thing that you need to see. A lot of times, particularly in our Midwestern world, right, we give up some peaks so that we don't have any valleys. We just like making those safe, practical decisions, and it's understandable why. But what happens is sometimes we don't get to see what our resolve is. We don't get to see what our passion is. We don't get to see how much we really care about each other. We say things like love and support and care, but we're not always prepared to actually use them. We're not always prepared to actually act on it. And what I saw yesterday was an opportunity of people that wanted to come out and act on it and put their money where their mouth was.
Julian, just a few minutes ago, we had Congressman Dusty Johnson on the air. I asked him what conversations he's having with Black leaders and community members in South Dakota. And he said maybe that's the easy temptation to only talk during what he called flare-ups right now. What would be your response to South Dakota leadership who perhaps are concerned about appearing opportunistic in starting this conversation, but want to do more to serve their constituents?
Well, you know, one of the things, and I'm a guy that I'm going to be very real in the answers that I give. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that I think has happened over the past few years is we have missed several opportunities to actually engage in the community the right way. And so whether you're a representative or a senator or even a local official, we have really missed the boat to engage in the conversation and educate ourselves on what Black issues are, what the issues are in the Black community. You know, I know the Sioux Falls Police Department has some really good methods of educating themselves, but honestly, I haven't seen it really extend past the police department. I'm a law enforcement officer myself, and one of the things that I say constantly is that we cannot effectively and efficiently police a community until we are effective in understanding that community. And I believe the same goes for politics. You cannot effectively and efficiently create policies for the community until you can be effective in understanding and learning about that community. And so as one of those Black leaders in the Sioux Falls community, I know Vani is one, and I meet with several other Black leaders constantly about the issues that we have in the community. I can honestly say that I have not talked to Representative Johnson. I have not talked to Senator Rounds. I did have a conversation with Senator Thune. He actually has been engaging with me on some of the issues that we have, not just in the Black community, but also in the entrepreneur community. He has been engaging, but I haven't heard from any other elected officials about what they can do to help, how those policies can be equitable, and how we can participate in that process.
Vani, are you seeing a similar situation?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think one of the things that I'm appreciative of is that, you know, I have a level of access, and we have a level of access that most African Americans in most places don't have, right? We can sit with the chief, we can sit with the mayor, we can sit with, you know, most of the people that we need to. But that's only part of it, and only a few of us have that type of access. The question is what are we going to do with it, and are we willing to do things that are going to make people feel uncomfortable? There are people that say to themselves, why were we doing that yesterday? Why did that need to happen? Which speaks to two things. It speaks to the lack of context and the ignorance in that particular situation. But what it also says is that, again, because things are working for certain people, they are comfortable with the status quo staying the way it is. So when someone challenges that status quo, it seems as though there are people who are resisting. And we need leaders that are willing to look those people in the eye and say, in this particular instance, you are wrong. There are more people in this community than just you. Not everyone is going to look the same as you, think the same as you, behave the same as you. And you have to understand that you're not allowing someone to live in this community. You're not allowing someone to be on your lawn. It is their community as well, and you share it. And the identity of it will flex with the people who enter into that community. And so we need leaders that are willing to share that message. And sometimes you have to tell some people, it's not about you right now. And those are the things that we're looking for. That's the initiative that we're looking for that we think will really get this ball rolling, is to be able to say sometimes we have to be focused. People seem to be comfortable with the idea of people of color having a specific problem, but they're not comfortable with the idea of us having a specific solution.
Vani, speaking of this idea of not making things about you, what I've seen on social media as far as the organization of yesterday's event is that it was organized by, I believe, a couple young people who have not necessarily wanted their names out there because they want the focus to not be on them, but on George Floyd and the broader movement and call for justice. Talk to us a little bit about how yesterday's event came together, thousands of people, starting with just a couple folks in the community.
Yeah, well, you know, you have some great young people who wanted to take initiative, you know, and I think that's amazing because there's a lot of grown people that didn't, right? You know, we're not talking about 15, 16, 17, 18 events. That's not what was happening. And so there was a lot of people who didn't step up in that particular way. But I think once it starts to grow, when people get into this work, they realize that there's so many elements to it. And how do you manage 1,000 people, 2,000 people, especially with the pressures and the energy of all the things that are happening nationally? So thankfully, Julian was able to reach out to them, and they had a connection, and Julian really helped them in terms of establishing that relationship with the PD and making sure that we had safe routes and that the crowd was safe, and we made that work. And then they engaged the rest of the speakers, including myself, in terms of, you know, the tone, the energy of it, some of the technical pieces of it. How can we make sure this is something that's impactful? And then even starting to engage into the conversation of what we do afterwards, because we want to engage our young people. We want them participating in the process. So I have a lot of pride in the idea that some people stepped up and wanted to do this. And I think this was such a great example of how we can bridge that gap generationally. When I was younger, you know, it was much more rare for young people to have a seat at the table. And that's becoming less and less the case. And I think this was just a great opportunity for us to figure out how we could be better at the organizational side of this, which is a hugely important in terms of making lasting change. Yeah.
Julian, we have just a few moments left before we have to take a break. In just a couple seconds, what do you anticipate being next after yesterday?
You know, part of what we did yesterday was we had an opportunity to bring these young people, as Vani said, to the table, and they were able to sit down with the mayor and the chief of police and also the sheriff of Minnehaha County. And I think there was a real genuine consensus around the table that there needs to be some form of solidarity moving forward. You know, we may have missed the boat prior to that, but we all found that we had a common interest, which was the interest of the citizens in this community. And so moving forward, what I would anticipate is that we would have a very strong partnership with the city the county, the police department, and not just having conversations and not just creating platforms of education, but actually creating programs surrounding unity and solidarity.
On Monday, Congressman Dusty Johnson joined us for a discussion.
Congressman Johnson, welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for taking time for us today.
Of course, Jackie, anytime for you guys. It's been, how many more dimensions of tough times are we going to get here? It's been a kind of a crazy few months.
Right. And I know, we originally scheduled you to focus on that work with the meat supply chain, but I'd be remiss to not ask you for your response to the calls for justice we're seeing in South Dakota and around the country. I saw over the weekend Senator Rounds put out a statement calling for justice for George Floyd. As far as I've seen so far, you have not issued a comment on social media that I've seen. Clue us in on your thoughts and your perspectives on what we're seeing right now.
Yeah, and I'm glad you're asking, because I do think this is a discussion we've got to have as a country. And I actually don't know that social media is all that conducive to it. I mean, I know that's the natural inclination as everybody goes to figure out what their 140 characters has to be. But I mean, this is something, frankly, I've dedicated a fair amount of time, even just in Congress, to. And we can talk in specifics. But the real move toward social justice, toward ending racial discrimination, we're not going to get that done by a tweet. This requires a lot of work. It takes years, work that is often done out of, away from the TV cameras and away from, the crowds. It's real people who have to do the kind of blocking and tackling that are necessary to take the steps forward. And George Floyd's, his death was a terrible tragedy. And it should serve as another reminder to all of us that we are not where we need to be as a country. And I understand that the protest, peaceful protest, can play a role in kind of advancing that conversation and focusing our attention. But obviously, the violence doesn't. The violence is totally and entirely counterproductive toward us making the kind of progress we need to make.
Tell us about the conversations, or what conversations are you having with Black leaders in South Dakota?
Yeah, and for me, this is not, I think that's the natural inclination for so many political leaders, right? Ooh, there's a flare up, let's talk to people within the community. And, that sort of seems like it's unfortunate. I mean, these should be conversations you're having on an ongoing basis. I mean, a man should not have to die in Minneapolis for us to have conversations about moving forward. And frankly, a lot of the attention nationally is now on discrimination against Black Americans, and we should spend a ton of time talking about that. But for me, I've been passionate about race relations vis-a-vis Native Americans in this state. And, I've got the Ben Rifle internship in my office that is, set aside for people who care about tribal issues. I mean, often, Native American students who want to further this so that they can be in our office learning, how government can be helpful, and we can learn from them, from their experiences. I've been the floor manager on for the bill that provided much needed funding to historically Black colleges and to tribal universities and colleges that benefit, a number of places like, Cynthia Galeska in South Dakota that are doing really good work educating a next generation of leaders. And so I would tell you the conversations I've had in the last week, they are more emotional. They are more pointed than the ones that I have had over the course of the last decade. But I think they're more valuable because they build on the relationships that I've built over the last decade. I think the number one concern I'm hearing most from people is from, leaders within, whether it's, I would just say, generally people who want more social justice. Their biggest concern is that they hope when the TV cameras and the radio reporters go home and the protesters return to whatever they are going to be doing next, that we don't lose focus on the work that has to be done.
So what are some of those concrete actions or ongoing conversations that you're looking to be a part of as far as the situation we're looking at? Because I think it is fair to say that to only focus when there's a flare-up would be disingenuous. So what are your plans beyond that?
Yeah, and this has been, as I said, a passion of mine for a long time. You go back to when I was chief of staff to Governor Dugard and the work we did in the Public Safety Improvement Act. I mean, we have, there are a lot of racial disparities within our criminal justice system. I think that criminal justice reform did a number of, I think, helpful things in trying to make sure that our system was better focused on, rehabilitation. I mean, getting people well, making sure that they were not a threat to our communities. I mean, we do need to hold offenders accountable. We absolutely do. But there's a way to do that improves public safety, and there's a way to do that ultimately compromises it. And that was a big push. And I still think as a country, I mean, South Dakota has done a pretty good job. I mean, some people called that effort one of the most comprehensive that has been done in the country in recent years. The federal government is behind that. I mean, about 2 years ago, we passed the First Step Act, which even by its name, projects its modesty and its incrementalism, the First Step Act. We still have a ways to go with that. I think that there's an opportunity for us to diversify our police force. And I actually feel like some of these, some of the violence has actually probably made it more difficult for us to go out and recruit people of color into our police departments and our highway patrols. But that is one proven technique to make sure that our law enforcement departments are more understanding of some of the challenges facing communities.
Stemming off of your mention of working with issues related to Indian country here in South Dakota, I know Governor Noem said in weeks past in conversations about the tribal checkpoints on a couple reservations in our state that she sent some information to the state's congressional delegation. I'm wondering if you've had any conversations with the governor on this matter or your perspectives on that.
Yeah, we have been in contact, and I mean, obviously, it's an untenable situation. I mean, I don't know what the right legal answer is, Jackie. I'm no constitutional law expert. I have read a number of briefing memos, including one from the Congressional Research Service that I requested because I was curious about what the legal framework is. But I don't know what the right answer is. Frankly, there's some case law that kind of conflicts with other case law. To me, I just hope we can get to a point where everybody is able to realize the key value they want. I mean, Harold Frazier wants to keep his people safe. That's not an unreasonable value for him. He understands that there are some situations on his reservation that make his people particularly susceptible to COVID-19. I think that's a legitimate observation on his part. I think the governor wants to make sure that people are able to travel on U.S. highways. And if they're not stopping, or if they're going to visit their own property, should they be unnecessarily detained? I mean, focusing on some good values. So to me, what I'm hopeful, I mean, maybe this has got to go to a court case. I don't know that in the long term is all that helpful. Maybe it is. But to me, I do like the efforts I've seen, from the governor in the last couple of weeks where she's trying to talk about finding some sort of solution with Harold Frazier and with Oglala Lakota, with Pine Ridge, because I think we are smart enough to be able to solve this problem while still recognizing the key values that everybody's bringing up.
And related to COVID-19, as I said in our intro, we've noticed some of the weaknesses in our meat supply chain and our food supply chain as a result of this pandemic. I know you've been working on some legislation related to that issue. Update us on how you're approaching this particular challenge.
Yeah, and I've been a co-sponsor of more than a dozen pieces of legislation dealing with the livestock industry over my 18 months in Congress. Most of them introduced long before COVID-19 hit the shores. This is something we've understood the weaknesses in the market long before coronavirus arrived. Mm-hmm. But I do think coronavirus brings some additional attention to the weaknesses. I mean, one bill that I am particularly excited about is just trying to make it easier for these small meat lockers in communities to process more and to have their product be able to be sold in more places. They have, it's sort of insult to injury, Jackie. They are willing to work a Saturday and Sunday, not necessarily because they want to, but because they know that a producer has to have some place to take that animal and the consumers need to have some place to go get their meat. And so they're willing to work those extra shifts, work really long hours. But then the federal government comes and hits them with this massive bill for overtime for the federal inspectors that have to be there. And so my bill would just say, listen, let's have this be a cost share. I mean, if you're a small meat locker, 10 or fewer employees, we're going to pay 70% of those overtime costs. You pay 30%. It's still a cost share. But this gives you an opportunity to, you know, we're not going to disincentivize you for being open. And it would also help medium size. I mean, well, they're really small, but between 10 and 500, you know, employees. This doesn't help the Smithfields or the Tysons, because they already have, I think, an advantageous situation with regard to federal inspection. But this is going to help the little boys, and I think that's going to help. And then I also think we need to make sure that we're doing everything we can to support their efforts to keep their employees safe. I've been to Smithfield. I have looked at the process, the protocols that their employees have to pass through, the screening they have to get done to get into that plant. We have got to keep these workers safe.
What's your impression of the rest of Congress's kind of response to this legislation that you're working on related to this issue?
If they are located anywhere near cattle country, they really get it. I mean, they are also vexed by this. They like the thought leadership we're bringing to it. They love my my beef to school lunch bill. We have lots of locally grown fruits and vegetables in school lunches, and studies have shown that students are more likely to eat them. Students feel more of a connection. They better understand where their food comes from. It's been a big success. Well, we're not doing that with locally grown beef and bison and pork, and there's an opportunity to do that. When I talk to my colleagues in Congress about that bill, they get excited, both on the right and on the left. I mean, there is sort of a broad coalition that can be brought together as people understand the value of some of this local sourcing. And, you know, one other one I would just mention there is, I think, an increased understanding on the part of my colleagues about why having four packers control 85% of the beef market does not create a very well-functioning marketplace, and that we have to look into some incentives or some data or some, you know, deregulation activities, just something that will make it easier for other people to break into this marketplace. Four packers is we have too much concentration.
Congressman Johnson, in just about the final minute or so before we let you go, I just wanted to open the floor as far as any other COVID-19 related relief or any other projects you're working on in Congress. What can your constituents expect from you for the next period of time?
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot of COVID-19. We have seen staggering job losses, and you know, Lori and I have talked about that, and it seems like, I mean, every time we talk, things have gotten worse than I expected that they would. And she does a nice job of sort of pushing me of, well, you said the Paycheck Protection Program was going to stem some of these job losses. What's going on? I think there is still a place for a Congress that is focused and targeted and open to the idea of finding innovative ways to make sure that people can keep their jobs. I don't love the idea of having them lose their jobs and then putting them on 12 different, you know, social safety net programs. People want to work. People want a connection to this job, and I think we're going to need to put more money into the Paycheck Protection Program. I think we're going to need to make sure that system has the flexibility so that employers can bring people back, and I'm going to keep focused on that. And, of course, you know, tomorrow is the primary election, so registered Republicans are going to get a say in whether or not I deserve another 2 years, and I've been working hard, and I sure would love to have an opportunity to keep working hard.
Sioux Falls Mayor Paul Tenhaken campaigned on his ability to serve as a dynamic and innovative leader for a vibrant and growing city. Since his election, he has led the city through natural disasters and a pandemic. This weekend also saw thousands of people take to the streets of the city. Mayor Paul Tenhaken joins us for a look at what happened and what's ahead for the city.
Mayor Paul, thanks for being here. We appreciate your time.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for having me. Since taking office, you have had one challenge after another, and one of the things I remember during our interviews before your election was you talking about your leadership ability, your ability to reach people in their homes via the internet and social media, and provide that inspiration and that leadership and that policy that they needed, but also to surround yourself with the kind of people who are going to help you figure out how to do things, from pothole repair, to policing that were not in your personal experience. And I wonder if we could start our conversation by talking about some of those people right now who have been essential to your decision making. Who is at your right hand, and has that goal that you had before becoming mayor ended up being something that you can stand by now and be proud of?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. And, a lot of times the mayor or the governor or president, whoever you are as elected official leader, you take the arrows and you also get the credit for things when things go right. And I'll tell you that decisions that are made in our office, there is an army of people that are really making them. So the mayor is the face, but I've leaned a lot on our emergency response manager the last 12 months, a gentleman named Regan Smith. I mean, he has earned his salary tenfold because of what he's been asked to do and the hours that guy has put in and some of these disasters that we've had. But city attorneys, your finance people, obviously the attorneys keeping you out of the ditch, but the finance people making sure that the impact, financial impact of some of the things that we're experiencing right now are minimized as much as possible. You have a lot of risk people advising you on, the risks of different decisions that you're having to make, the legalities of those decisions. And so a leader is only as good as the people that are he or she surrounds himself with. And that's what I've really tried to stress to the people of the city of Sioux Falls is like, listen, you have an incredible city staff. We have 1,300 employees and I have 12 in kind of my executive cabinet that are helping make decisions to lead us through things right now. And that's been incredibly well received. I think people do appreciate the leadership of the people, not just in the mayor's office, but the rest of the city employees and how we've responded to things the last several months.
I want to talk a little bit about putting things in perspective because you recently did a Facebook Live conversation with Sioux Falls people and said, I don't want the story of the looting to overshadow this broader conversation. One of the things I noticed was how easy, as you scrolled through Twitter, for example, it was to become the line between what was happening in, Minneapolis or New York City or Fargo became almost blurred with what was actually happening in Sioux Falls, and you really had to engage, your thought process for fear that you would forget where certain cities had seen certain kind of problems. So how bad was the situation in Sioux Falls? How widespread was the looting?
Well, the situation was tense. I mean, it's been a long time since our SWAT team, mobile field forces had utilized tear gas in the city of Sioux Falls. And it wasn't an overreaction either. I mean, it was a tense situation. While there's a lot of investigation going on, a lot of stuff I can't talk about, there was certainly, it was a challenging several hours on Sunday night. And it was a side of this city that I don't think anybody really ever thought they would see. And to your point, there was a strong gathering of support from 5 to 6:30 in downtown Sioux Falls on Sunday. And you're seeing this across the country where there's strong support and peaceful protests happening. But all of that legwork that is happening with those protests is being overshadowed by what's happening usually when the sun goes down. And that is what's so frustrating right now, because these riots are counterintuitive to the end goal of having civil discourse and conversation on how we address the issues of the racial injustice and inequality challenges that we face as communities. In some cases, there is a culture of police misconduct. We've avoided that in Sioux Falls, and we have a great culture of professionalism in our police department, but some departments aren't as lucky, and they have a history, track record of police misconduct. And so people are frustrated with that. They're dealing with that. But it's important for people to also say, what's going on in my community? And I can watch what's going on in Minneapolis and in Miami and in New York, but you need to separate that from what's happening in Sioux Falls and what's the tenor here and what are we seeing here, and know that the way that we're responding and the way we're addressing those things will look a little bit different because we are different, because we aren't the same community as some of those others. Some of the underlying tensions are the same across the board, but the way we've reacted over the years is different than how some of these other communities have reacted over the years.
I have been hesitant to use the word riot with what happened in Sioux Falls because of how many protesters were lined up in front of police and how many protesters were intervening in the people who were trying to, you know, break windows or throw rocks at law enforcement officers. Are you okay with calling it a riot? Is that how you wanted to see it reported in the news?
I called it a peaceful protest that turned into a riot because it absolutely did. And I don't know how you would classify gunshots going off and rocks being thrown at police officers and looting and windows being smashed out as anything but. And it is absolutely a riot. And that's why we've been making arrests. We have a couple more arrests we just made this morning from people who are going to be held accountable for those actions because it's, you know, the purpose of the protest was sound. The message needs to get out there and be heard, but not at the expense of the law. And we are a country of laws. We're a nation of laws. And it's why we have mechanisms by which to exercise your right to peaceful protest, to have free speech. But the ends don't necessarily justify the means.
Governor Kristi Noem, in her press conference today, answered questions from the press about what can be done in South Dakota. What are some of the tangible strategic steps that need to be looked at to address police misconduct, to address police brutality, to address the issues that thousands of people are taking to the streets to raise awareness for? She was asked about body camera footage being public record. She was asked about, or she mentioned, qualified immunity on the federal level. She mentioned on the local level contract negotiations with police departments and how they handle officers who have been charged with misconduct, how often they're reinstated. As just general overview, you know, she didn't get into specifics, and I'm not asking you to get into specifics, but I am wondering what some of the steps that you think need to happen next. How do you address the message of the protesters who say, our experience here in Sioux Falls is intense enough for us to come and take to the streets and ask to be heard. What's next for the Sioux Falls Police Department once those voices have been heard?
Well, you know, this is the challenging, most challenging part of the discussion is how do we move forward now? Okay, once the dust settles, you know, literally and figuratively here from all this, how do we move ahead? And Sioux Falls, over the years, has implemented strong community-based policing programs. We have SROs in every school in this city, school resource officers, that are working alongside these the kids in our community. Specifically, they spend a lot of time with our kids of color and the immigrant communities in our city. In some cases, we have multiple SROs at some schools with higher needs. We have a community ambassador program where we have people from different ethnic groups and minority groups across the city who, for lack of a better term, they're kind of pseudo-deputized by the police department. They go through training, and then they get to work within the communities that they are members of to help build police relations. We have all kinds of community outreach programs with our police officers. All those things have been happening for many years, and they have been successful. And the reason I can say that is we had a lot of kids and a lot of people in our community who weren't part of the violence that we saw on Sunday night. But I will say for a fact that some of our SROs were standing in the front lines on Sunday night and seeing the kids that they worked with for years. And we have to question, why is that? Why has all that work been erased in a single evening? And so those are questions we need to figure out, where that anti-police sentiment in Sioux Falls is coming from in certain circles, because for all intents and purposes, We don't often see that. We don't get a lot of complaints in this department. We don't have a history of injustice with our officers. We can pull files and you can see police complaints, and it's very few and far between. So that's where it's important to recognize, again, I know that this issue is one we need to discuss and address, but I also think it needs to be looked at on a case-by-case, city-by-city basis and say, okay, what's the history in Sioux Falls? And what have we done in Sioux Falls? And what do we need to do better here? Because Minneapolis, quite honestly, has a culture in their police department and a track record of police brutality with people of color. And that's been very well documented. And so their match was very close to being lit already with the death of Mr. Floyd. And those people have had it. They are sick of that culture that they've seen in Minneapolis. And I think that's what sparked that as the epicenter. That's why they simply can't get control of what's going on there, because that pain and that hatred towards law enforcement is rooted in some reality. And it's justified in some ways because of that history. And so what we have to do as elected leaders is we have to recognize that. We have to come face to face with that and say, hey, Minneapolis, while it's not Sioux Falls, those issues exist here and those thoughts exist here. Perceived or otherwise, those are realities that we have to address. And how do we begin that? That's what we're trying to figure out. What does success look like in this? Because the past 5 to 10 years, we've really doubled down on our efforts to be more involved in the community with our diverse communities in Sioux Falls. And in some ways, I think it's paid dividends. In some ways, there's still more work to be done.
Tony Harrison is the National Trustee for the South Dakota Fraternal Order of Police. He is a captain with the Rapid City Police Department and joined us Friday for a conversation about police accountability and policing in South Dakota.
Tony Harrison is a captain with the Pennington County Sheriff's Office and National Trustee for the South Dakota Fraternal Order of Police. We welcome him now to the program to visit with us about policing in South Dakota and in Rapid City in particular. Captain Harrison, welcome back to In the Moment. Thanks for taking time for us today.
Thank you for having me.
So to start off the segment, we know that protests are continuing on several days in a row now in Rapid City. I wonder if you're able to give us any kind of update related to those ongoing protests where you are right now.
Yeah, we've had several different groups that have done some protesting and some marching around the area. And I will tell you, they have all been... for the most part, very well behaved. They've caused no problems, if you will, other than we've had, I think, 5 or 6 arrests in total that we had to deal with individually on one night. But as a whole, folks are expressing their First Amendment freedom of speech peacefully, and we are certainly thankful for that, and we certainly support their ability to do that.
Mm-hmm. Let's start with how officers are continuing on after the events of the last couple weeks. How are you and your fellow officers kind of viewing these protests in South Dakota, and how are you dealing with some of the tensions that are there?
You know, we support everybody's ability to say what they'd like to say. So when you ask how we're dealing with them, we're dealing with them like we do every other planned event. We're there to keep the people involved safe. We're there to keep people who don't like the message of that group safe. And so we're dealing with like we do everything else. Now, I guess the difference of this, of course, is when you watch TV or you read the newspapers or you listen to South Dakota Public Broadcasting and you hear about all of the stuff happening in New York and L.A. and, you know, people can get that in their mind as that's what's going to happen here. Mm-hmm. And luckily for us and thankfully for all those involved, that's not happened here. So I would say, you know, almost the anticipation of what could happen is worse than what is happening. In fact, I'll tell you, it is worse than what is happening because, like I said, all the folks that we are talking with and dealing with are really doing a nice job of obeying laws, obeying traffic laws, and saying their piece and not causing major problems for anyone. And we're grateful for that.
Mm-hmm. Much of what protesters are working with is ideas about law enforcement reform, from a lot of probably the most extreme end being abolishing police altogether, then throughout the spectrum, various policy reforms. Talk to us about, you've worked with the Rapid City Police Department, now you're with the Pennington County Sheriff's Office. Talk to us a little bit about maybe starting with how law enforcement officers are trained in your area when it comes to escalation in arrest situations or any level of training as it relates to race relations.
Right. So those are kind of two different layers.
Right.
We'll talk about use of force first. Use of force is taught really from day one. And use of force... our use of force level starts at officer presence, right? So when you have a deputy or an officer or a trooper show up in a uniform, that is a use of force because people recognize we have a gun and a badge and the ability to arrest people. Therefore, we carry a little more authority, whether they agree with it or not. And so that's the first level of force. And then, of course, it goes up from there from verbal directions and hands-on and all the way up, of course, to the use of deadly force. So when officers, troopers, police officers get hired, right out of the barn is not only that physical training on how and when to use it, but the criminal or the legal training in terms of what we're allowed to do. And the Graham, there's court cases out there that talk about reasonableness and the reasonable amount of force that we're allowed to use in what situations. There's not a flow chart that we can go to and show that if A happens, we do B. Mm-hmm. And if this happens, we're allowed to do this. And there's not a chart that says, if someone does this to you, you can only do this back to them. Mm-hmm. Because it's based on reasonableness, because we all know everybody perceives things different, and we all know that different levels of action require different levels of reaction. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So... and that also comes down to officer stature and size and suspect stature and size. So you have a 6'8" person who's mad and there's a 5'4" officer, mm-hmm. that use of force may be different than a 6'8" officer and a 5'4" civilian. And so those all come into that reasonableness that we use in our training and when we're teaching legal and when we're teaching the actual physical use of force. Hmm. The other half of that you talked about is the cultural and cultural awareness and the community awareness side of the house.
Right.
We do the same. I know the police department does the same, and I'm sure the highway patrol does the same, although I don't work for them, but I work very closely with them. I know we get a cultural training from the very beginning. We have Native American deputies here who have come in with their families and taught us, even as recently as the last year or so, some of the historical aspects of the history of the Black Hills. Mm-hmm. And while I personally know most or a good chunk of it, a lot of our newer officers, especially when you get officers and deputies from outside of the area who don't understand, they're coming from Minnesota or they're coming from Kansas and they don't know the history of the Black Hills and how we've gotten to some of the places that we've gotten to. And so that's very important for them. And I know the State Academy does that as well. So we do focus very hard on training all of our sworn law enforcement in the Rapid City area about that, because you have to understand the historical to understand why some people today are very angry, and I don't blame them. And all we can do is continue to work to educate our folks and to always teach our deputies, our officers, and our troopers around the area that you always have to remember there's another side of the story, not just one side to include our side or their side. It's all of our sides. They have to be combined to have the best relationship with your community.
Right. Branching off of that a little bit, talking about reasonableness and how that can often be in the eye of the beholder or in a very situational kind of determination. Looking at the situation with George Floyd, many people looking at that video would be hard pressed to call that reaction reasonable. But when we talk about reasonableness of the response, we also note there were multiple officers responding to that particular situation. So I guess I'll pose the question to you. When it comes to multiple officers on scene, maybe multiple points of view on what is a reasonable response to the unfolding situation, how what's the role of accountability among officers as they're responding to things?
So here's how I'll answer your question.
Yeah.
I'm a captain with the sheriff's office. Mm-hmm. I would expect if I were doing something that was not legally, morally, and ethically correct, that a one-year police officer walk up to me and go, sir, that's not right. You need to stop it. Mm-hmm. I expect to be held accountable the same as I would hold them accountable if I saw them doing something. Now, I have some rank, which so with me comes a little bit of authority when I say stop, people typically stop. But we do train our officers, our deputies, and everything else to hold each other accountable because we do have to do everything legally, morally, and ethically correct. And if someone is not doing things legally, morally, or ethically correct, we expect to hold each other accountable. And so I guess I'll answer your question with, I would expect our folks in this area to make sure things are done properly based on their training, which is based on legality, morality, and ethics.
Hmm. I guess no part of law enforcement is easy, but I can imagine as best as I am able being a rookie officer seeing misconduct unfolding by someone with rank above me. It's tricky.
it's you are absolutely right. And that is one of the things when I talk about that, you know, legal, moral, and ethical, that we do teach them. I talked about on day one, we talk about, you know, the law side of it. That is one thing we teach them is at no point is anyone supposed to do anything wrong. And if you see it, this is a tough position. You have to make mm-hmm. tough decisions, and you have to get out of your comfort zone many, many times. And so it is tough to look at a senior officer. Let's say you're in training, right? And you're the rookie and you have this training officer. And this training officer is the one who's kind of guiding your training. And this training officer is the one that gives you the check mark to say, yep, they're ready to hit up the street on their own, or nope, they need more training. And so you really have to depend on that person to help you get through the system, right? They're the ones that are guiding you, and they're checking the boxes that say this deputy is good to go. So you see that training officer doing something wrong, and how do you stand up and say, I have a problem with that? That is exactly the dilemma that we have to deal with daily. Mm. Not that we have people doing things wrong, but there's decisions all day, every day that we have to make, and we have to question each other, and we have to hold each other accountable. And I'm proud to say at the sheriff's office, we do that. Mm. And I know the Rapid City PD does that as well. We hold each other accountable, our chief and our sheriff. They hold each other accountable. Myself, Captain Olson from the PD, Captain Johns from the PD, and Captain Hughes from our office, we hold each other accountable because we believe the greater good has to be the better, and we're not afraid to have those tough conversations.
Hmm. What's the role of the everyday citizen in that accountability, or even in building that sense of community between law enforcement and the rest of the community? Maybe that's where we start that question. How is that unfolding?
You know, I get some of the certainly the citizens' frustration with the system. Mm. I do. You know, the United States justice system is not perfect. Is it the best system in the world? It's the best one that I'm probably aware of, but it's not perfect. And we do have flaws. We have holes. And remember, that goes both ways. You know, we have folks that do really, really bad things, and sometimes they may get a pass for whatever reason. And the reasons could be many. And for us, that stinks. But that's part of the system that we work in. And I'm not saying anybody should get a pass to do something wrong. What I'm saying is sometimes everything has a flaw, and our courts and our justice system is not the absolute perfect fix-all to end-all. But I know it's a good system that is grounded in good policy and procedure as a whole. And I know the folks around here believe in the system, and we will continue to keep that system working properly and working fairly, because everybody has the right to have the system treat them fairly. And if it's not treating them fairly, I don't support that at all. I 100% think the system should work the way it's supposed to work.
Hmm. Earlier this week, Governor Noem discuss some possible reforms that she would be willing to look into if the legislature should bring them forward. Some of those include looking at qualified immunity. Some of those include looking at the appeals process. If an officer is fired and then is able to appeal that decision and potentially regain their job, what's your perspective on some of those discussions? Are those adequate to respond, or should we be looking elsewhere?
You know, I didn't see those, so I don't feel comfortable, you know, commenting whether I think they're good or bad or
sure.
not. What I can tell you is that we have to have the best police force is made up of the citizens of the community, and so and the best sheriff's offices. So if we have folks who struggle with the way things are, I encourage them to come in, apply, and come work with us and help us become better. And I think that is one of the best ways to fix those. If there's gaps, to fix those or fill those, but also to have the inside understanding of how and why we do how what we do. Mm-hmm. We have some Native American deputies and officers, but not a ton.
Right.
I would love to see more of them. But we don't have as many. And our jobs are always available. PENCO/jobs is where you find them. And I would encourage folks that if they want to get involved, that's the best way to help change, is to get involved, because we will take it and we will listen.
Now that's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. Again, if you're looking for an individual segment from our radio program, you can find all of our segments at listen.sdpb.org or by following the In the Moment Segments podcast. And if you have a story idea, send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Lori Walsh and Chris Loffrey, I'm Josh Heyer. Thank you for listening.